Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. It's a full plate for our legal roundtable panel on today's program, as the U.S. Supreme Court has ended its term and put it into the history books. Lots of 11th-hour activity on key issues, and a term that changed the face of the court with the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. He is gone, but his death left a divided court and still influenced some important rulings. We'll talk about it and more with our regular panelist, attorney Bill Freivogel, journalism professor at SIU in Carbondale. Mark Smith is not with us today. He's taking a day off. Also with us from Washington University School of Law, Susan Appleton and Elizabeth Sepper. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Nice to have you.
Thank you.
Well, the big one was yesterday, the abortion ruling bill. I'll start with you. If you can give us kind of a thumbnail sketch of what that case was about, then we'll talk about its impact.
Well, Texas had passed a law that had, in particular, two requirements that were challenged. One was that a doctor performing an abortion had to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital, and secondly, that abortion clinics had to have hospital-like facilities, ambulatory clinic facilities. And this had resulted in a number of the abortion clinics in Texas closing down, more than half. And so the question was, is this posing an undue burden on a woman's right to choose? And the Supreme Court ruled that it did, that there was not much, that there really wasn't any evidence that there were health benefits for women from the Texas law. The Texas Attorney General wasn't able to cite a single case where there had been a woman who would have benefited from these this law. On the other hand, there was a very substantial burden on a woman's right to choose. There were whole portions of Texas where there would not have been an abortion clinic within 100 or 150 or 200 miles.
Dozens would have had to close.
And so this was seen, I think, as the most, as the Supreme Court's most strongest abortion rights decision in about 25 years.
Susan Appleton, it was a 5-3 decision, and that surprised a lot of people. Were you surprised?
I was gratified that it was 5-3 because it brought some certainty to the issue. And I think most notable was that Justice Kennedy joined the majority. He would have been the senior justice in the majority, so he would have had the prerogative of assigning the opinion to the justice who wrote it, who was Stephen Breyer. And Kennedy and Breyer had been at odds on some past abortion cases, one in 2000 and that Breyer wrote was almost overturned in 2007 by an opinion that Justice Kennedy wrote. And this case seems to bridge that gap and puts Justice Kennedy squarely in the camp that favored recognizing abortion rights. And I think that there's some important clarifications of the undue burden standard along the lines that Bill mentioned. Originally, that standard had surfaced in an opinion for only three justices in 1992. Now, a while back, it was clarified as being the now prevailing standard, but it wasn't clear what it meant. And I think yesterday's ruling gave it some clear content.
Liz, the reach of this ruling goes far beyond Texas. It's a national issue, actually, and Missouri very much affected by this, probably.
Right. The decision has immediate effect only for Texas law, but many states, including Missouri, have requirements for abortion providers in particular to maintain admitting privileges or to operate as ambulatory surgical centers. And in fact, in Missouri, the result of those regulations has been that we have one abortion provider in the entire state, which really does stand out, I think, among the various states. And we're already seeing effects. Alabama has already announced that it won't continue to defend its admitting privilege law against constitutional challenge. And the Supreme Court rejected cert, which means it's not going to consider them. It's going to let the decision stand that struck down admitting privilege requirements in Mississippi and in Wisconsin. So we're already actually seeing national effect.
Bill, what would you see as a next step in Missouri with regard to this?
Well, I think that there, well, I believe there is already a case involving the Columbia abortion clinic that closed. I don't know if that would be the vehicle, but it would seem as though Missouri, which was the very first state, I believe, to pass a submitting privilege as an ambulatory clinic requirement, it would seem as though that those laws are very vulnerable to a fresh challenge. And Columbia would be a very likely spot, I think, for there to possibly be a clinic that would reopen. You'll recall that initially the University of Missouri had given a doctor their admitting privileges, but then under pressure withdrew that. And so there's a case that involves that whole issue in federal court, I believe.
Liz or Susan, further thoughts on that?
Well, I wonder now if something like Missouri's 72-hour waiting period becomes constitutionally vulnerable, given that the court has rejected these women protective rationales unless there's actual evidence that shows that women are protected by the law in question. So I raise that as a question. I'm not sure what will happen with that.
Liz, does this effectively put the abortion issue on the back burner for the Supreme Court? I've heard that said, that it was such a strong decision that it's probably going to do just that. What do you think?
I think it might dampen some of the enthusiasm that state legislatures have shown for enacting lots of laws under the guise, and the Supreme Court has now exposed it as a guise, of protecting women's health. And I see yesterday's decision as really a win for evidence-based medicine, that just like with other medical procedures, we're going to think about the best way to promote quality of care, medical practice supported by science, and providing care in the most rational setting, right? You don't get your toenails cut in the emergency room, and you shouldn't be forced to get an abortion in a surgery center, especially medication abortion, as the Supreme Court said.
Yeah, the Supreme Court pointed out that that having birth is much more
13 or 14 times more. Yeah,
more. And yet states allow there to be births at people's homes. But I guess I don't have a lot of confidence that this is going to cool the ardor of state legislators to pass more restrictions. Take Missouri. If you could some way count up all of the legislative days over the past 30 years, that and maybe a little more than 30 years, that have been spent passing abortion laws that were clearly unconstitutional, it would be enormous.
Susan?
Another possible tactic might be to avoid these particular restrictions and focus on prohibitions on certain methods of abortion. The Supreme Court upheld the Congress's so-called partial birth abortion ban act, and there's been some other legislatures that have singled out particular abortion methods and tried to prohibit them. So that could be the way to go.
Right. Yeah. But
I think the challenges will continue.
Liz?
I mean, I don't mean to be Pollyanna. I don't think that the abortion debates are over. Americans remain fairly divided over this issue. I think we'll probably continue to see 20-week, maybe 18-week bans, maybe fetal personhood laws, right? Missouri, of course, debated one. These have been unsuccessful for various reasons. I think extended waiting periods actually are likely, and maybe fetal tissue disposal laws. Indiana has this horribly cruel law that requires women, even who have miscarried and therefore have gotten an abortion or been raped and got an abortion, to pay to bury or have cremated the fetal remains.
Well, it's not going away one way or another. It certainly is going to be talked about for a long time to come, I would think. Let's talk about the affirmative action ruling of a couple of days ago, upholding the University of Texas affirmative action rule. Is there an impact here as a result of that ruling? And again, in Missouri, colleges, universities?
Well, I don't know that there's an impact here. I just don't know the affirmative action programs of each of the universities in this area. I think it was a very surprising, a somewhat a somewhat surprising decision in that it was written by Justice Kennedy. And Justice Kennedy has in the past not been a particularly big fan of affirmative action. He had left the door open in sort of the previous incarnation of this Texas case, but hadn't seemed to leave it open very far. But in this decision, he somewhat surprisingly upheld the Texas affirmative action plan. And the Texas plan. One reason that I think the overall impact is a little bit limited is the Texas plan is very sort of unique. And I think he himself, called it sort of sui generis. So, for example, they have this. The legislature has imposed this one part of affirmative action, which is the top 10% of the graduates from high schools get into the University of Texas. And because, of course, that only works partly because lower high schools are very segregated in Texas, as in most of the United States. So that results in there being a substantial number of Hispanic and Black and other minorities. But then Texas found that there were still, 50% of the classes didn't have any African American or Hispanic students. 75% of the classes had only one student, and so they felt as though there needed to be an additional plan on top of that. That was what was being challenged by Amy Fisher, and that additional plan has all sorts of factors, and one factor is diversity. Within diversity, race is one factor of diversity. They include socioeconomic diversity, and race is another. So Kennedy himself called it a factor within a factor within a factor. And so race was not overall that important, and upheld it on the basis that diversity is an important, compelling interest that the government has.
What was the vote?
5-3.
Go ahead. Susan?
So I was going to add that it was 5-3. It's one more bit of evidence that Kennedy might be joining his more liberal colleagues in cases where that was not originally expected. But I thought it was also interesting that he has learned from Justice Ginsburg. And the part of the plan that Bill mentioned that sets aside the top 10% because that works because high schools are racially segregated. And Justice Kennedy acknowledged that and cited from some Ginsburg opinions. And so he's acknowledging that even the part of the plan that supposedly was race neutral, it was actually used because of its racial effects. And I think that's an important move.
Go ahead, Liz.
Well, I would like to add, too, that this term, right, was actually expected to eliminate affirmative action in public institutions, at least public universities, once and for all. So I think it would have had a major impact going the other way. It would have put public universities at a real disadvantage as compared to private universities. And another thing to note, which bears some similarity to the abortion case, is that Justice Scalia's death didn't change the outcomes in these cases, right? Affirmative action here would have been 4-4. Justice Kagan was recused, and the Fifth Circuit's opinion in favor of the state of Texas, of the University of Texas, would have stood, and the abortion case would have been 5-4 instead of 5-3. So that's a sort of interesting twist to these cases.
We can get into the Scalia factor a little bit later in the program. While we're talking about diversity issues, I'd just like to point out here that it was noted during the course of the last couple of weeks that St. Louis University is launched an outreach program to increase the number of minority students that are attending their law school. So that should be acknowledged at this juncture. Have to take a break. We'll do that now. Continue our Legal Roundtable panel discussion in just a moment. My guests in studio are Bill Freivogel from Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, and also Liz Sepper and Susan Appleton from Washington University School of Law. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our discussion with Susan Appleton, Liz Sepper and Bill Freivogel. Let's take a quick look at the immigration issue. The court really had a sharp rejection to President Obama's plans and proposals for immigrants. How sharp a rebuff is that?
Well, the only reason I would not call it a sharp rebuff is that it was a 4-4 tie. I mean, they didn't have an opinion. They were deadlocked. But the result of that is that a lower court judge in Texas who put a national injunction against President Obama's plan, that national injunction stays in effect. So, you know, when the Supreme Court doesn't actually have an opinion, I wouldn't call that necessarily a sharp rebuke, although certainly the Republicans wanted to call it that.
But it does stop that.
It does
that
stop it.
That stop the whole process. Any thoughts, ladies, from you on that, or shall we move on?
Well, one thing interesting, Stephen Legomsky, who's one of their colleagues at Washington U and used to be in the Obama administration's immigration service, was saying that one possible thing that, say, a President Clinton, if there is a President Clinton, could do would be to have some sort of a process where there was a more sort of like individualized consideration of some of these cases, that might be a way that would you could have a new executive order that would be based on not a blanket kind of approach, but a more individualized approach. Of course, I think the first thing that a President Clinton would try to do would be to try to get Congress to actually pass a law.
So I would just add that had Justice Scalia survived, I think we can surmise that the case would have come out 5-4 against the Obama administration, and that would have been a definitive rebuke.
not only 5-4 against the Obama administration, but probably since they had added some issues on presidential power and, you know, on separation of power to that case, and it could have been a really strong rebuke, actually.
While we're talking about this part of it and Justice Scalia, has his departure and the 8-member court really been as problematic as people thought it would be when he died? Anybody have thoughts on that?
Yes, I think it has been problematic to have only 8 justices. I mean, we really do see that in the immigration case. You have here a 4-4 split, no opinion, no guidance for the future, but also a national injunction coming from a district court judge who had previously spoken publicly against this exact policy, something that federal judges are not supposed to do, or if they do, certainly should not be making decisions that affect the nation. And we don't have a lot of answers. The 4-4 split was surprising. This is separate from the substantive issue. This is substantively important, but there are lots of civil procedure fans who were surprised that the state had standing. So standing is a doctrine that means you have to actually be injured. You can't just take policy disputes with the government into the courts. You need to go to the legislatures. Here, Texas said it was injured because it would have to issue driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants who request them. But the federal government said, A, you don't have to issue licenses, and B, you could charge those immigrants for the entire cost of the license, and then you wouldn't have an injury at all. But the 4-4 split suggests that 4 justices think that states can bring policy disputes with the federal government into the federal courts, and that would be a major change.
Any other thoughts on that? Okay. Go ahead. Susan, you look like you're – okay. No.
On the Scalia issue the 4-4? Well, I know that my colleague Liz has spoken about the birth control access case and what the division on and the fact that there were only 8 justices has been for that.
So that's another case from about a month and a half ago involving the contraceptive mandate. Nonprofit employers around the country challenged it. And the big question is there a burden on them just from being accommodated, right? They have to submit a form to the government and then they're out of the process. And it was a unanimous opinion. It wasn't 4-4, but it was a strange opinion. The court came up with a sort of bizarre solution that looked almost exactly like what the federal government had already done, and then said, you know, you guys are pretty close to settlement, so why don't you go back to the lower courts and work it out? The problem with that is, one, they didn't look like they were close to settlement, but two, there's lots and lots of other possible plaintiffs, and the settlement between the government and these individual plaintiffs doesn't resolve the issue for the rest of these employers.
The point I wanted to add about Scalia's absence, or the absence of a ninth justice, is that we tend to focus on outcomes and we count votes and see whether or not we have a majority or a 4-4 split. But we neglect to think about what the participation of a particular justice in conference might have meant, whether or not there's some persuasive force that justice could have brought to bear. And so who knows? Maybe some of these outcomes would have been different had Justice Scalia survived or had Merrick Garland been confirmed.
Yeah. Another issue the court dealt with earlier was the question of police stops. Bill, I'll take this to you because I know you see there's a relevance here with regard to Ferguson. Basically, if police make an illegal, unlawful stop, they can seize evidence and use it.
It was. It didn't seem as though anyone other than Justice Sotomayor had actually been paying attention to what happened in Ferguson. And Justice Sotomayor in her dissent mentioned Ferguson very specifically. So what this was is a case where police had, on a hunch, stopped a person and then checked his identity, found that there was a bench warrant on a minor traffic violation. Based on that, searched him, found some sort of drugs, and the Supreme Court said that you could use that search and what you found to prosecute the person.
Even though the stop was
even though the stop was really basically not
no probable
legal.
Cause.
Right. No or even reasonable suspicion.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to some of the St. Louis U Law professors about this case a week ago, and Mike Wolf, you know, the dean over there, was saying, you know, if you see a car with four African Americans in it, and you stop it, you got a really good chance, particularly in North St. Louis County, of one of them will have a bench warrant for failure to appear to pay a fine or something, and so then you're good to go for searching, search and whatever kind of prosecution results from that. It just seemed to me as though the Supreme Court didn't seem to be paying attention to what the reality was on the streets. I mean, the Supreme Court was saying, this doesn't really happen that often. Well, it does happen. It happens a lot.
And I think Justice Sotomayor's dissent was so powerful because she did grapple with the impact on real people's lives. She cited the Ferguson report from the Justice Department. She cited Ta-Nehisi Coates' book, Between the World and Me, Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. So she really immersed herself in that literature and brought it to bear in terms of shaping her views of this subject.
She was so passionate about it, it almost became the story, that passion, rather than actual ruling, ruling itself. Okay, a couple of other things that were decided yesterday. We can dispose of these fairly briefly, I think. Former Virginia Governor Bob McDonnell, basically off the hook on charges that he was a bad boy during the time he was the governor.
He could be re-prosecuted, I guess. I don't think the government has announced whether they would. But this was the Chief Justice saying, or the court saying, that trying to set up a meeting for somebody, making a call for somebody is not an official act for which you can be convicted. The question that arose, it's going to make it harder for federal prosecutors to have these public corruption prosecutions. I don't think it will affect Blagojevich. That was the first question that sort of occurred to me, because I think there's no question but that there was an official act involved in his, one of the charges against him was filling Obama's Senate seat. That would pretty clearly be an official act.
Blagojevich, you're talking about.
Blagojevich.
Yeah.
And Blagojevich is supposed to be some of the charges against him were thrown out, but he's going to be resentenced next month. I don't think that this is really going to help him. And his lawyer is quoted in the Chicago Tribune as saying that he didn't think it would help him.
But McDonald was a question of he was getting Rolex watches and cash, wasn't he? I mean, that's a little bit different. But Blagojevich, as far as I know, never received a nickel.
He never was able to succeed in getting the money. I guess that's right. But, Robert said it was tawdry, but that tawdry didn't make it necessarily illegal.
And the focus was on what McDonald had done. not what he received. In other words, it was on whether he performed an official act in exchange.
The gifts to him were not illegal at that point under Virginia law.
His wife off the hook also? Because she was caught up in this
as well.
I think
the case was remanded and...
Yeah, I think hers, I think she will, hers will probably be affected in the same way. Mm-hmm.
There was another story that popped up relating to the Supreme Court recently, and that, I guess it's in the rumor stage, and that is that Justice Clarence Thomas is preparing to retire and resign. Have you heard that and to read it? I mean, I read it in
Yeah, I read it, but I think it's rumor. Rumor is the right word for it. I don't think there's any reason to believe it.
Well, that would come at an inappropriate, well, an unusual time,
yeah.
Wouldn't it, if in fact that were the case. Okay, let's move
and
on.
And he's not that old. He's like 68, 69. He's not that old.
Well, he's a spring chicken compared to some members of the court. No question about that. Okay, one other thing from yesterday, and that is the ruling prohibiting guns for people convicted of domestic violence. Anything to say about that? That was just
Pretty interesting. I thought that was a really interesting decision. Particularly in that, you know, it's this whole argument that the pro-gun forces make that there's this Second Amendment constitutional right to bear arms just about anywhere you want to be. I mean, the Second Amendment didn't even factor into this decision.
Except
although
in Justice Thomas
thought it should have.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I think it shows pretty clearly that as Heller, the decision that recognized an individual right to have a gun to protect yourself in your house, as Heller stated, it's not an absolute right, and states still have states and the federal government still have plenty of room to regulate guns.
This is an issue that's not going away here in Missouri either. The governor earlier this week vetoed concealed carry legislation without a permit. But, Susan, I expect we're going to be hearing more about that fairly shortly.
I think that there will be efforts to override that veto, and they may well be successful. And I think it's important to put that situation in the context of the case that Bill was discussing that upheld the prohibition on possession of firearms by those who had been convicted of domestic violence misdemeanors involving no more than recklessness. And I think what that shows is that the legislatures do have leeway to regulate firearms. But if you have a legislature like Missouri's that doesn't want to impose restrictions, then they're free to open up the use of firearms.
And I just want to add, I wouldn't expect to see legislatures broadly include misdemeanors on the list of crimes that prohibit ownership of a firearm. But in this case, it involves domestic violence. And as we know, most people convicted of domestic violence are convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence rather than felony domestic violence. So this was considered an important issue to tackle, not just gun violence per se, but violence against one's family members.
What does that say, that domestic violence issues are considered misdemeanors as opposed to something more serious?
Well, I think they're often pleas to misdemeanors in those cases. And they are complicated cases because sometimes the victims of that violence decide that they don't want to go full bore, and the prosecutors will defer to that.
And from what I'm reading, it seems fairly likely that there will be an override of Governor Nixon's veto because the legislature, they have the numbers.
They have the votes of both the Senate and the House.
Unless anyone changes his or her mind.
Right. It looked like one Democrat was changing his mind, but there were six in the House, but six Republicans had not been there for the previous vote, and they already had a 3-vote margin, so in a 1 or 2-vote margin in the Senate. So it seems like it's pretty likely that it'll be they'll be overridden, and it's an incredibly broad law. You can carry a gun you can carry a concealed weapon wherever you aren't prohibited from having a gun. Like you couldn't carry it into a church or a school, but anywhere else you can carry a gun. You don't have to have a permit. You don't have to have gone through all the sort of licensing.
You can buy a lifetime permit for $500, I think, or five
Great
years
deal.
For $100. Well, that's something, again, I suspect that we will be talking about. I have in my notes here that since we last got together, Bill, a California court has ruled on conceal and carry. This may be headed to the Supreme Court by the Federal Appeals Court in Frisco, ruled that Second Amendment to the Constitution does not guarantee the right of gun owners to carry concealed weapons in public places, upholding a California law.
Yeah, I think the California law may say that you have to show that you have a good reason that you need to have a gun.
Specific counties in California had required that, and the federal courts mm-hmm. there said that that was permissible within the bounds of the Second Amendment. To me, that simply shows that you need a legislature interested in restrictions before you test them constitutionally. If you have a legislature that wants to get rid of restrictions, mm-hmm. There's no constitutional issue.
Is this something that's likely to go before the high court?
I think it could. Yeah. I think it was 7-4, maybe.
I think it was.
In the appeals court. But, the overall theme I take away on this gun issue is that there is, even though the Supreme Court has recognized an individual right to have a gun to protect yourself in your house, that there is plenty of room for regulation of guns that does not affect the Second Amendment right. That Second Amendment right is not an absolute right, is not a Second Amendment right to carry, as so many gun promoters say. And there's plenty of room for legislatures if they have the political will to do something.
I wonder about Congress. I mean, following the sit-in that we had, there is some suggestion that maybe there could be some movement. Perhaps
possibly.
Following the election.
There's a attenuated local connection to the sit-in in Congress because that was led by John Lewis, and he was the commencement speaker at Washington University.
Yeah.
And as part of his commencement address, he said, if you see something that's not right, not fair, not just, do something about it. Have the backbone to get in the way. And I wonder if his words here helped give him the confidence to take on that issue.
He is such an iconic figure. Mm-hmm. You think the fact that he has taken this particular position might cause some people to rethink.
Apparently others who organized it recruited him to be the face of this particular sit-in.
Right. Okay.
He has this additional moral authority mm-hmm. that
absolutely.
Comes with
absolutely.
His history.
And he knows a little something about sit-ins. There's no question about that. Let's take another break. We'll do that and come back. We have a caller who wants to get into the gun issue. We'll do that when we come back. And other things for us to talk about, too. This is our Legal Roundtable panel discussion with Susan Appleton, Bill Freivogel, and Liz Sepper. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation with our legal panel here, Liz Sepper, Susan Appleton, and Bill Freivogel. But let's go right to the phones. Jerry's been waiting since the beginning of the program. He wants to talk about guns and gun control, so let's bring him in. Go ahead, Jerry. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. It's always nice to hear some intelligent conversation. Yeah, I had questions about the it's like the trifecta of if you're a gun advocate, because now anyone can carry a gun. And apparently the Stand Your Ground laws sound, I haven't seen specifics. I would love to have the bill number so I could look that up, allows
Google
you
it.
To not even retreat. And then the other part, as I understand it, and this may be my misunderstanding, is that in the, I guess, the Castle Doctrine, or basically if you were in the process of defending your home, and apparently even against a perceived threat, you cannot be... be brought to a civil action cannot be brought against you, and this is not limited to, say, an alleged perpetrator, but if you fired through your window and it goes through into your neighbor's house, if you're in the process of defending your home, you're exempt. And I don't know if that's true the way it's been written, but I would like your comment on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. Anyone have a thought?
Well, I don't know about your exact hypothetical about going into the neighbor's home, but it is true that The Stand Your Ground is part of the bill that Nixon vetoed and that we think will probably be overridden. And it's also the Castle Doctrine is expanded, like visitors to your house. A babysitter is similarly protected by the Castle Doctrine in your house to use force against a perceived threat. So it is, I mean, it's a very, very broad pro-gun piece of legislation.
Thanks for the call, Jerry. We have Dennis in Overland wants to talk guns, too. Then we'll move on. Dennis, go ahead. Make it quick, if you would, please.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of like where Jerry is. I was just wondering whether, I have two things. I'm wondering whether since the court might be becoming a little bit more progressive in the near future, whether some court cases might start making their way through that will, you know, maybe alter it for the whole country. My second thing, and this is for another day when you have your legal panel there, I would like to hear all of their thoughts on a justice that's no longer with us, and that is Lewis Powell and what he has done to this country with his Powell Doctrine. Another day, but thank you, Don. Great show.
Dennis, thank you so much. We'll save that for another day because okay. There's plenty to talk about. Any thoughts with regard to his gun issue?
Well, if Congress enacted certain firearms restrictions, we might see something with an impact on the whole country. But even if courts are otherwise more willing to uphold restrictions, those restrictions have to come from a legislature that has the political will, as yeah. Bill said.
I mean, I don't think like Missouri's law would be found to be unconstitutional, even if it's very broad, because it wouldn't really violate any part of the Constitution I know of. One thing that might be mentioned is that it is within the realm of possibility with Scalia's death that if there is a President Clinton and there's one or more appointments from a Democratic president, that one of the cases that could be reversed would be the Heller case, which found this individual Second Amendment right to have a gun to protect your family and your house. It was a 5-4 decision. There was a very strong dissent written by Justice, I think it was Stevens, saying this was never what the Second Amendment was about. And so it is one of the cases that the Supreme Court could switch on if there's a more liberal replacement for Scalia.
Okay, I'm going to take another call now, take us to a different subject, one that I wanted to get to, but Luke wants to get to it as well, so let's have him do it. He's calling from South St. Louis. Go ahead, Luke.
Hi, Don. Thanks for the program.
Yeah.
I'm calling about the case where Jennifer Joyce's office is withholding identifying information of witnesses to defense lawyers, and I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. It seems to me that she's outright breaking the law, but I guess there's probably more than one way to look at that. So what do you think about that, and what do you think the ramifications will be of the decision in this case?
Thank you so much. Too bad we had a bad line there. But did you all get the questions? Mm-hmm. That's the redaction issue that I think we're all familiar with. She is excluding some names and addresses and pertinent information from defense attorneys in certain cases, thinking that she is protecting witnesses. Thoughts?
Well, I can understand. I understand what her motivations are because – I mean, there can be situations where witnesses may feel as though, they're jeopardized if they come forward. And I know that Jennifer has spoken on this program and other places about how one of their very biggest problems in prosecutions is getting witnesses to appear in court and not be intimidated. So I understand where she's coming from. But if you actually, as the caller says, if you actually read the statute, which, Don, you've nicely sent to us, yeah. So I could read it. It does seem awfully clear that there's this information is supposed to be turned over to the defense counsel so that they can prepare a defense.
Let me just read the first part of that. It says, except as otherwise provided in these rules as to protective orders, the state shall, upon written request of defendant's counsel, disclose to defendant's counsel such part or all of the following material and information within its possession or control designated in said request. The names and last known addresses of persons whom the state intends to call, and it goes on and on, basically saying, provide this information. I think there have been 175 or so cases over the last decade in which she has not done that. And yet there was a case recently where there was a witness to a crime that was shot and killed in his home. And Jennifer would say, and that That's because the information concerning this person's address was available. Where do you go from here on that? somebody tell me.
I mean, there are mechanisms in place that do aim to protect witnesses or those bringing charges against dangerous defendants, right? You can get protective orders. You can get orders from the court. You can work with defense counsel and subject them to orders that don't allow them to disclose that information to their clients, for instance. So there are ways to protect in instances where witnesses would actually be in danger. But to paint with a broad brush in this way seems dangerous to the defendant's constitutional rights.
Yeah, and I think that's important to emphasize, that it's not just that Missouri has rules protecting defendants here, but that the Constitution guarantees defendants a right to a fair trial, and that has typically been interpreted to include having access to such information, except in exceptional situations.
There was to have been a hearing on that. I think Judge Mullen was to hold a hearing, and I thought it was to have been last week. Does anyone here at the panel know if that has happened?
It appeared that there was a hearing June 22nd, but I couldn't find any follow-up information.
Well, I guess he's, you know, reserving a decision or whatever. In any case, it's a very interesting case. Mary Fox, who heads the Public Defender's Office, basically says it denies her clients the constitutional right to a fair trial.
I mean, I see in the Post-Dispatch story that Mullen, the judge before who had the hearing, did not issue a ruling Friday, but it seemed to be leaning towards the public defenders, according to this reporter.
Okay. One other issue, we have a couple of calls. I'll try to get to those as time will allow. But I wanted to bring up something, Bill, we've talked about before on this program, but it's happened again. And that is Chief Dotson and what he calls a rant, you know, is taking on the judges for being a little bit too lenient in cases, primarily gun cases. It's very interesting to have a chief of police taking on the judiciary. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, he sure isn't making any friends on the judiciary.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Maybe he's and you know, is he making political points? I mean, I guess people sometimes wonder whether he's going to have a political career. Although, you know, I must say, when I look at the individual cases that he's citing in his, I guess these are actually tweets, aren't they?
A blog. Yeah.
That you do wonder why this guy, you know, found with illegal guns. Is sent home with an ankle bracelet and on pretty minimal bond. So I can sort of see where he's coming from. But it may not be the most – I don't know if it's the most persuasive way to get judges to act differently.
This is the second time that he's done that. Susan and Liz, do you have any thoughts about this particular tactic?
I agree with Bill that it's very interesting. But I think we have to wait and see how it plays out.
Let's take one more, then we'll go back to the phones, and that concerns Melissa Click, who is the professor at Mizzou, University of Missouri at Columbia, who received something of a reputation last year during the turmoil on campus for calling for muscle during a demonstration. That's been fairly well documented. Well, now the American Association of University Professors has voted to censure the University of Missouri on this, and what caught my eye is, what does that mean? What does a censure mean? And what you ladies are with Washington University, what does it mean? What can the professors do to the University of Missouri?
They can give a bad name to the university. They can, if, say, the university were in hot competition with another university for hiring someone, it may be a factor in whether or not that prospective faculty member chooses University of Missouri or some other place. I don't think it has any enforcement mechanism, but it just gives the school a bad name. I was on the Washington University chapter of the AAUP for 10 years. And what happened here seemed very familiar, because what the university was called on was the failure to provide procedural protections. And the AAUP cares very much about procedural protections. It rarely weighs in and second guesses substantive decisions. And so this was not a comment about whether or not Melissa Click could have been terminated for cause on the basis for what she was, but rather whether or not she had an notice and an opportunity to tell her side of the story before a decision was made.
Yeah, I'm no fan of Melissa Clicks. I don't like what she did to the student journalists who were trying to, you know, record what was going on at one of those student protests last fall. But I'm really not a fan of firings that are done by totally procedures that are set aside for just this one person and that are taken under pressure from the Missouri legislature threatening to cut off money to the University of Missouri if they don't do something about her. I mean, that's what happened. The legislature threatened the University of Missouri. University of Missouri did not follow its normal procedures for how to handle a case against a university professor and fired her. And I think that's, you know, that may well be a violation of her due process rights. So her rights are important, too.
What about her? I mean, we don't have crystal balls, but is she going to have trouble finding a job because of this? I mean, is this a stigma, a stain on her reputation?
Probably. I think so.
I think probably. I mean, she looks so, those you know, the photos of her doing what she was doing in the videos, they certainly don't portray her in a very nice way. So if you're on a faculty search committee and you know about this history, I mean, you probably can find another person who's every bit as good.
Yeah, and in terms of Mizzou losing money, my understanding is they're losing $30 million in lost tuition monies for this next term. That's
and I don't think she's found another job because didn't I read that she was seeking unemployment?
Yes,
right.
Compensation.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to get a quick call in here. Time is giving us limitations. Brian in St. Louis, make your comment or question very quick, please.
Yes. I've been following the cases about the inalienable rights and hearing about the judges throwing them out. And after being thrown back, some of these cases being brought back to the courts, just wondering where the state is on that.
Are you talking about guns now?
Having a gun. For all citizens, even though some of these cases are gentlemen with prior records.
Okay, and your specific question is what again, please?
Just wondering where the state is on that inalienable right to bear arms, where the gentlemen were actually prior felons, but then you know they're exercising that right.
Okay, I think we've got it. Go ahead.
I think this goes back to the domestic violence case that the U.S. Supreme Court decided. And I guess the majority of the court disagreed with the caller's description of this as an inalienable right, that the right to bear arms, to the extent it's protected by the Second Amendment, does allow for state regulation. And the court found here, as we've discussed, that perpetrators of domestic violence misdemeanors that require only recklessness can be restricted in their right to bear arms.
A minute left. Very, very quickly, I'll go through the panel. The Supreme Court, what sort of a grade do you give it for this term?
Well, I think given that there were eight justices, I think that they did a good job. I think if you compared what people expected this term would very likely be sort of a more conservative result term. It wasn't because Scalia died.
Uh-huh. All right. Liz, do you have any thoughts about that?
I think I would have given it a C for sort of limping out of the term, with the exception, I think, of the affirmative action surprise and the proof that constitutional rights do matter, even though they can all be regulated, right, that we still have a right to abortion. So I'd give it a pretty high grade then.
Susan,
I come out with a pretty high grade as well, notwithstanding some obvious disappointments like the immigration case.
Well, thank you all so much for being with us. It's been a good discussion. I certainly enjoyed it. Hope the audience did. Hope you did, too. Susan Appleton, thank you for being with us again. Liz Sepper, great to have you with us. A rookie on the program. We'll certainly have you back.
Thank you.
Bill Freivogel, great to see you again. Mark, you missed a good one, if he's listening. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. It's a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.